The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Our first case for argument today is 19-2211, Taylor v. McDonough. Mr. McLeod, please proceed.
Chief Judge Moore, and may it please the court. For 35 years, Bruce Taylor was unable to get the benefits he needed because the Army threatened to jail him if he exposed its misdeeds. The Veterans Court concluded that it was powerless to stop the Secretary from depriving Mr. Taylor of the full relief to which he is entitled. This court should reverse that judgment for two independent reasons. First, the executive's action...
Mr. McLeod?
Yes, sir.
Judge Waller. My reading of the record is exactly the same as yours, that the Army threatened to jail Mr. Taylor. But in its brief, the government says that they rely only on the released form, which is a generic one from the Senate investigation, and that there was no such threat. In reading the record, it appears to me that there was such a threat for criminal prosecution. Would you please reference that?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree completely with you that there was such a threat. It appears in the language of the secrecy oath, which we have reproduced in part on page 8 of our opening brief. I would also note that the government takes an inconsistent position on that point. They say, on the one hand, that there was no threat and Mr. Taylor could have applied to the VA for benefits, and on the other hand, that this information was so secret that the Army could not even disclose the names of the Edgewood participants to the VA itself. And I would also further point out that if there were no threat, if there were no real enforcement of the secrecy oath, there would have been no reason for the Army to release Mr. Taylor and other Edgewood veterans from the oath in 2006. So, Your Honor, I simply don't credit that argument on the part of the government.
McLeod, this is Judge Proust. Let me ask you about the right of access point of our case. Now, in Mr. Taylor's case, national security seems not to necessarily be front and center. Mainly because matters were long ago declassified and his claim is therefore backward-looking. And as an aside, the government, as we just suggested, seems to be suggesting flexibility and security oaths, which some of us may have a problem with. But in any event, my concern here is, hypothetically, if we were to find for Mr. Taylor in these circumstances, what does that mean for future cases where national security is front and center? Namely, in cases where matters remain classified and have never been classified, and a veteran comes in and with a claim and wants essentially forward-looking benefits. Can you discuss to me how you envision that process working if we were to find Mr. Taylor in this case?
So two responses, Judge Prowse. The first is that with respect to whether there's a compelling interest in national security in general, we, of course, don't dispute that the government has an interest in keeping certain things secret. As Your Honor noted, that interest is not a compelling interest in this case because there was disclosure of information about the Edgewood program as far back as 1976, and also because of the inconsistency in the government's position. However, I would argue that there are no real implications for a finding in this case because the court can assume that national security would be a compelling interest in future cases and still say that the government didn't narrowly tailor its restrictions to that national security interest in this case. I would also note that this is a problem that to a large extent has been ameliorated by the government going forward. So for example, today, if a Navy SEAL is injured on a covert mission, the government has established procedures that that person can use to seek benefits. The problem Mr. Taylor and Edgewood veterans face is the government never bothered to create those sorts of procedures for them, and so they are stuck and were never able to seek benefits, even through some sort of covert mechanism like the ones that exist today.
But we have, since 2006, a specific provision in 3.156C that appears to deal with this kind of situation. And in adopting that rule, the VA said that this just reflected past practice, existing practice that has been true for decades. So Mr. Taylor could have applied for benefits just describing his symptoms, filed an informal claim, without disclosing anything about the classified program, and that would have gotten him the right to retroactive benefits when the records became declassified under that provision. Why isn't that an available remedy to him?
Well, Judge Dyke, for a number of reasons. First, I'm not sure that Mr. Taylor actually could have filed that minimal claim. He was under a threat of prosecution if he disclosed information about Edgewood. And so
I think he doesn't disclose anything about it, but it's about the symptoms of which he was well aware, and this is service connected, and that's sufficient placeholder to allow him to get retroactive benefits later.
Well, Judge Dyke, the problem is that in that scenario, there's no way that Mr. Taylor could have established service connection at the time that he filed the application. And if you look at the cases that the government cites for the proposition,
well, sure, that's absolutely true. But it would have been sufficient as a placeholder under cases like Shea and so on, where people file claims saying, I have these symptoms. That's sufficient to allow retroactive benefits later, isn't it?
I'm not sure about that in this case, Your Honor. My understanding is that Mr. Taylor, in those circumstances, would need to show a clear and unmistakable error on the part of the VA at the time that it denied his initial application. And in the scenario that Your Honor is positing, if Mr. Taylor doesn't come forward with any evidence to establish service connection, that's not an error, as the Veterans Court has interpreted that standard. So I think Mr. Taylor would be left in a very unusual and untenable situation. And again, I would reiterate,
I think you're mistaken. I don't think that Q applies under those circumstances. Under our decision in Cook, the fact that the records were unavailable at the time makes it retroactive regardless of Q.
Well, Your Honor, I would emphasize the fact that Mr. Taylor is operating under military orders. Those orders are not to be construed against the drafters. And so it was perfectly reasonable for him in these circumstances to feel constrained from seeking benefits because he was told not to disclose this information to anyone. And so I don't think the court should put Mr. Taylor to this Hobson's choice of facing potential prosecution in order to get the benefits that he earned through his service.
Mr. McLeod, I thought your view is that there was a constitutional violation in 1971, 72, and I'm going to bring it all the way up to 2006, a year in which two things happened, the declassification and also the creation of the retroactive 3.15c remedy. But that wasn't available for 35 years, was it, when the constitutional violation, in your view, was ongoing?
That's correct, Your Honor. I understood Judge Dyke's question to be on the assumption that the provision reflected past practice of the VA. My understanding is there was no such past practice. Mr. Taylor certainly wasn't aware of any option that would have allowed him to seek benefits. And so we do think that the constitutional violation existed at the time Mr. Taylor separated from service and was under the threat of prosecution because of the secrecy oath.
Mr. McLeod, this is Judge Hughes. Let's assume that there is a constitutional violation here and that the government's secrecy oath violated his right to access. And setting aside equitable tolling and equitable estoppel, under what authority, statutory, equitable, or otherwise, do we or the Veterans Court have the right to tell or the VA to set aside 5110?
Your Honor, the VJRA establishes the authority for the Veterans Court to set aside decisions of the Secretary that violate constitutional rights. And so if this court were to find a violation of the right of
action. 7261, right?
That's right.
Okay. So 7261 tells them they can set aside the decision. But what I'm asking is what specifically allows them to tell the Secretary when it reaches a new decision that it has to disregard 5110?
Your Honor, I think it's the same provision. This is, in effect, an as-applied challenge. We're not suggesting the 5110 is invalid in all applications. It's just the Secretary's application of that provision in the circumstances of Mr. Taylor's own case.
And so do you have any analogous authority? I've read a bunch of these right to access cases, and I don't see anything remotely close to this where they use something as general as basically a standard review provision to order relief. Usually the relief is grounded in equitable authority the court has, where some other statutory context, like in Bell, which is, I think, the closest analogous case, is grounded on 1985 itself. So don't find 7261 sufficient. Do you have any other place to point me to that would provide the Veterans Court or our court to direct the Secretary to disregard 5110?
Your Honor, I don't have a case in the veterans context. I do think that some of the earlier cases from the Supreme Court on the right of access, like the Johnson versus Avery case, rest primarily on constitutional principles. And so when they find a constitutional violation, they can validate whatever regulation or statute was at issue that caused the violation.
Okay, can I just follow up, and I'll stop. What authority, when they tell invalidated, what specific authority is it?
They cite the Constitution. They cite the Constitution.
What in the Constitution?
Well, Your Honor, the right of action.
Aren't they using the equitable power of a court to strike an unconstitutional provision or some other power?
No, Your Honor, that's not how I read the case. The right of access stems from a number of different provisions in the Constitution, including the First Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And so the court has, in a sense, amalgamated all of those various protections into a generic right of access that is constitutionally protected. So when courts applying the right of access strike down a restriction, they're doing it using their constitutional authority. And so for the
When Congress sets a time limit, you're saying that as a constitutional matter that it can't do that and that he has to be given the right of access to the courts. I mean, suppose Congress said explicitly you can't file a claim later, even if you were foreclosed from doing it earlier by a secrecy requirement. And you're saying that Congress can't do that. It's unconstitutional for Congress to do that, right?
Judge Dyke, I'm not taking the position that time limits in statutes are unconstitutional as a general matter. The court has recognized that there are a number of restrictions that Congress or the courts themselves can place on the litigant's ability to access the court that don't implicate the right of access. But in the circumstances of this case, where there is no compelling interest and where the government never narrowly tailored the restrictions to serve a compelling interest, we do think that there's a violation of the right of access.
So Congress cannot legislate to insist that he is foreclosed. In other words, it's unconstitutional for Congress to foreclose his claim.
Your Honor, if in the circumstances of this case, Congress were to say there is no option for Mr. Taylor to seek relief from the secrecy oath, then yes, that restriction would be unconstitutional because it's not narrowly tailored. As I was saying earlier to members of the court, the Department of Defense has created provisions and procedures these days that allow for veterans in the circumstances that Mr. Taylor finds himself in to seek benefits in a classified covert manner. So any restriction that Congress would impose would, I think, at a minimum, need to include those sorts of safety valve provisions that could be relied on by a veteran like Mr. Taylor.
Do you acknowledge there might be circumstances going forward in which the government would take the position that we can't narrowly tailor anything, we cannot do anything because of the national security risks inherent to a particular circumstance? What would we do in that circumstance?
Yes, Your Honor, I acknowledge that that could be the case. If we were talking about the nuclear codes and the government said there's no narrowly tailored way to allow someone else to access the president's nuclear codes, we would agree that that would very likely survive strict scrutiny. The problem in this case is not only is there not a compelling interest for the reasons that I was discussing with Your Honor before, but there were a number of different ways that the government could have narrowly tailored its interests that would have survived strict scrutiny, and it simply failed to do that for 35 years.
Counselor, if we were to find that there's a constitutional right of access problem, which court would have the authority jurisdiction to address the remedy? Is this something we have to send back to the Veterans Court, or is this something that we could address ourselves?
Your Honor, I think that the best course of action would be to reverse and remand to the Veterans Court for them to address it in the first instance.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions on the right of access claim, I would like to say a few.
Just one more. What's your response to the assertion that this is a fairly broad principle that you're asking for, that any government action that prevented somebody from filing in a timely way would be potentially unconstitutional at the post office? Because of anthrax doesn't deliver the mail, or it's a road closure to prevent people from going to court, or there's a government decision not to release documents on other grounds other than national security. Isn't the potential here fairly sweeping for the right of access to cover a lot of government actions that prevent somebody from filing on time?
Judge Dyke, I don't think so for this reason. The right of access has existed and has been applied by courts, including the Supreme Court, for going on 100 years now, and we haven't seen problems with the effect of that right of access in the national security context. And again, we don't deny that national security could be a compelling interest in certain cases. We simply don't think that national security justifies the restrictions that were imposed on Mr. Taylor in this case. And I would also
think that quite answers my question. My question is, isn't the principle that you're arguing for fairly broad and goes well beyond this case to any situation in which the government prevents somebody from filing on time because of federal release documents?
No, Your Honor. This is a case that is extraordinary, and it's extraordinary because it involves affirmative misconduct on the part of the government that is thankfully very rare. So the ruling that we're asking for, the only ruling, is to say that in the extraordinary circumstances of this case, there was a violation of the right of access. Again, we don't dispute the basic proposition that national security can be a very compelling interest that would justify even a denial of the right of access under the right circumstances. And if the court were to write that in the opinion, we would be completely fine with it. But we do think that this case is different because of the severity of the actions and the way in which the government violated Mr. Taylor's rights.
Counsel, before you switch to your other argument, I understand that our current state of the law would prevent you from making this argument, but it is true, is it not, that if we were to conclude that 5110 is subject to equitable tolling, that would solve the right of access problem. Is that right?
That would, Your Honor. We have preserved that argument. The only reason we didn't brief it is because the court, in its en banc order, directed us not to provide additional briefing on that point.
Right, but in your view, is there any doubt that Mr. Taylor would be entitled to equitable tolling in these circumstances?
Not in my view, Your Honor. Assuming that the court were to revisit its precedent that forecloses equitable tolling of 5110. But I think that if any case would qualify for equitable tolling, it is Mr. Taylor's case because of the circumstances of the imposition on his liberty and his inability to file for benefits in the manner prescribed by the statute.
Thank you.
Mr. McLeod, what if back in 1970, the VA, either through its manual or a regulation, informed veterans that if they didn't have their records, their service records for whatever reason, they should nevertheless file some type of provisional application in order to preserve an early effective date for any benefits that they may be able to be awarded at some future point. Maybe the records are currently lost, or maybe they're classified. If there had been such a provision in either the manual or the regulation back in 1970, then would you say that there's a right of access constitutional violation under that circumstance?
No, I don't think so, Judge Chen. In the scenario you're positing, the government is encouraging veterans to apply for benefits instead of standing in their way. And so there may be questions about the efficacy of that right. I could imagine a veteran arguing that even though they filed the claim, they should be able to put in more information to be able to establish service connection earlier. But in that circumstance, the government is not an obstacle, and so there's no violation of the right of access.
There was nothing here that actually stopped Mr. Taylor from filing such a placeholder application, right?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. It was the secrecy.
I'm sorry. Of course, in order to establish service connection, I completely agree with you on that. But in terms of just filing an application for purposes of preserving an effective date.
Well, Your Honor, from Mr. Taylor's perspective, the secrecy oath prevented him not only from establishing service connection, but from applying at all. Mr. Taylor interpreted the oath in the way that it's written. I think it's plain text, clearly says he's not to talk about what happened to him to anyone. And so he very reasonably decided that he could not file anything with the VA. And there has been an acknowledgement by the Army and by the Department of Defense that many similar Edgewood veterans felt the same way, and that the result of the secrecy oath was to preclude veterans from being able to seek benefits. That was disclosed in the Vietnam Veterans Litigation in the Northern District of California. So we think the record in this case plainly shows that Mr. Taylor felt inhibited from seeking benefits because of the secrecy oath.
Mr. McLeod, Chief Judge Moore, do you understand the government to have conceded in this case that had he filed such a placeholder claim, that would have secured his effective date? Because I read their brief, and the most I got from it was, it's possible it would have. It is conceivable it would have. I don't see the government as having suggested, and perhaps I'm wrong, and I'd like your view on this, that if he had filed a claim all those years ago, it would have, in fact, preserved his effective date, given that it would not have been able to allege, among other things, what his stressor was. So would you address that, please?
Chief Judge Moore, I read the government's brief exactly the same way that you do, and I think it's notable that the cases the government cites in that portion of its brief all involve veterans who lost, who were not able to establish the earlier effective dates for exactly the reasons I was discussing earlier, which is they could never establish service connection. So I don't think that Mr. Taylor should have been required to do a futile act that would expose him to criminal penalties in these circumstances, given the secrecy oath.
Mr. McLeod, I have a follow-up question on that, which is simply that wouldn't filing a placeholder application have required Mr. Taylor to understand that someday this confidentiality obligation on him would be lifted?
That's right. How
would he understand that?
That's right, Your Honor. At the time, if he had filed in 1971, it would be entirely speculative whether this confidentiality obligation would ever be lifted. And the fact that it wasn't lifted for 35 years, I think, shows that it was very reasonable for Mr. Taylor not to simply guess that one day he could file for this. And Mr. Taylor is a soldier. He was operating under orders from the highest levels of the government not to disclose this information. And so for him to just assume that, well, one day they might be fine with it, I think is simply not the way that a reasonable soldier would have reacted to these sorts of orders.
Mr. McLeod, following up even further on that, and if unfortunate circumstances had occurred and if Mr. Taylor had died during the pendency of all of this, what would have happened under those circumstances? If it hadn't been declassified and he had passed away, as I'm sure many veterans who were involved in this program had?
Your Honor, it's very likely that his claim would have been extinguished and the benefits would have gone away, even though Mr. Taylor earned them with his sacrifice and his service to his country.
Mr. McLeod, what if Mr. Grimaldi gets up in 10 minutes and says there was just no possible way to create some kind of alternative mechanism for benefits filing for the Edgewood Program veterans because of national security? The national security sensitivities were so high, it was just impossible. So therefore, there was no meaningful way to do this for people in Mr. Taylor's situation. Would we have the ability to review that determination by the government?
Yes, Your Honor. And with respect to Mr. Grimaldi, I don't think he could credibly make that claim. Because as I noted...
I know. This is a hypothetical, though. What I'm trying to get at is a larger question, maybe a separation of powers question, which is, to what degree do the courts have an opportunity really to even question and review a determination by the executive branch that something was so sensitive to national security that there just wasn't a possible alternative methodology to apply for benefits?
I understand the question, Your Honor. And what I would say is that sort of argument by the government is frequently made in cases involving national security concerns, and they are reviewed deferentially, I would say, by courts, but they are reviewed. An example is cases involving CIA information that might be subject to FOIA. Courts that review those requests, I apologize, Your Honor, I'm getting courts have reviewed that information and have found that FOIA applies despite the national security setting. So what I would say is this court, of course, should take seriously statements that are made by the government about what would or would not implicate national security, but those statements should be reviewed by the court just as the court would review the litigating positions the government takes on other issues that might be of high importance. This court has an important role to play in the separation of powers, and that's a role as a guardian of justice and to monitor misconduct by the government. So we think that for all of those reasons, the court is empowered here to find a violation of the right of access.
But you would agree generally that in those cases, Egan is one of them, the court has expressed a strong deferential standard to be applied on national security interests, correct?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I think that that's the standard, and we're not disputing that that sort of standard would apply. We simply don't think that it's met here, given the lack of a compelling interest and the government's ability to narrowly tailor a program that would have allowed Mr. Taylor to seek benefits at an earlier date.
Mr. McLeod, you're into your rebuttal time. Would you like to save it?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Grimaldi then, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, Mr. Taylor certainly comes before this court in a very sympathetic appeal. But
Mr. Grimaldi, this
yes.
is Judge Wallach.
Hmm?
I think one of the key issues here is the government's compelling interest. So I have a question about that, more or less a factual question. In 1997, we agree that Mr. Taylor was subject to the administration of sarin gas, right?
The record's a little confusing on that. On appendix page 31, there is a discussion of a gas. Then there's a piece of paper taped with his name on it. But it does appear from the record that he was injected with some sort of chemical agent. Whether it was sarin or something else dangerous, I'm not 100% positive on, Your Honor. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, it is something very dangerous to him.
Let's just say it was a nerve agent which was banned by the Chemical Weapons Convention in 1997. After that time, possession or use of that gas was illegal under U.S. law. How does the compelling interest continue after that date? I recognize up to that point, yes.
Well, I mean, Your Honor, in order for that, there would be to find out whether or not in 1997 the exact chemical agent that was injected into him was banned.
The whole class was banned.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, we talked over each other. Could you repeat that, please?
The whole class was banned.
The whole class. If we would have to know exactly what was put into his veins. And unfortunately, I don't think the record is entirely clear as to what exactly was put into him. You know, the United States, the Secretary has conceded that it appears it was something extremely dangerous.
Assume it was sarin or VX or one of the banned gases. What's the continued compelling interest?
Well, you know, when this in 2006 was the names of the individuals were declassified for purposes of getting VA benefits, the operational portion of it and things that actually occurred during it was not actually declassified. So the program that occurred back in the 1970s before anything was banned is classified for a reason. In Christopher, the Supreme Court said on page 417 that inquiry into the reasons behind the government's decision to undertake the national security action that it did in that case looking at it would lead to separation of powers issues. It would, judicial inquiry was the quote that the court said could lead to separation of powers instances. So for this court to look in 1997 and say, hey, now it's banned by treaty, why does the government have a compelling interest in keeping this classified, would be stepping into the province of the executive and the decisions it makes about what programs need to be classified and what programs do not need to be classified, Your Honor.
Okay. One other question. The government says that Mr. Taylor can't establish that the secrecy oath completely foreclosed his ability to obtain veterans benefits, but clearly, the Espionage Act completely forecloses espionage, does it not?
Correct.
So, if he can be charged under the Espionage Act, isn't he completely foreclosed? Remember, you're looking at it from the soldier's viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, it's interesting when you say we're looking at it from the soldier's viewpoint. We would argue that this is an objective standard, not a subjective standard. The question is whether or not he's completely foreclosed from court, not whether he believes he's completely foreclosed from court. It's a high, high standard. It's not a standard that's subject to his opinion on it, but rather an objective question of whether or not he can or cannot go to court.
Is it a question of his opinion, or is it a question of what the government tells him he has to think?
Well, it's the plain language of, I mean, I hate to say this, it's the plain language of the sample oath, and that's the hard part in this case. What we're reading is actually not the oath that Mr. Taylor swore to. It is a sample because it was all that could be found. And that sample...
Your opposing counsel disagrees with you, and my reading of the record disagrees with you as well.
My
prior opinion...
Of course, Your Honor. We completely understand that. And we understand that one could read the oath to say that he's foreclosed from talking to the VA about it. We don't read it as a complete certainty, which is why we lead with the argument that a minimal claim was possible here. That is the...
Just out of curiosity, this is Judge Moore. I'm truly baffled. He was subject to a secrecy oath, but you're saying, but it's not a complete certainty? Is it enlisted military men that should make the case-by-case assessment over who they think they can reveal secret information to and not reveal secret information to?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. It is that they are bound by the text of whatever oath they take. They are bound by secrecy, and we completely understand that. The question becomes whether the VA was an organization that had authority to know whether or not he was subject to injured in a classified program.
Yes, but I'm sorry.
Has the DOD or any other security agency taken the position? I mean, there are a lot of security oaths, but I think this wording is not uncommon. Has any of them taken the position that therefore what's not covered is that the person can communicate any information to one of millions of other federal employees? And they're not precluded by that security oath language from doing that? Is that something that I know you said it in your brief or suggested in your brief? Has any other national security or Defense Department agency suggested that officially?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, we haven't seen any policy statement or anything else on that. All we saw were the Ospedale, DeAngelis, Forrest, Stanley, Bishop, and Sweet cases, in which individuals specifically went to court or Veterans Court or District Court, Supreme Court, mentioning the Edgewood program. And
So your view is that Mr. Taylor should have somehow known other people had risked it? And we're talking about potential criminal penalties here for disclosure. So
correct.
You're suggesting that nobody that we know in terms of the DOD or the security agencies that are responsible for crafting and implementing these security oaths have construed it in a way that you suggest, i.e., that it doesn't foreclose discussion of everything and anything with any other federal employee, you're thinking it would have been reasonable for him to take that risk?
Well, Your Honor, I think the most reasonable option for Mr. Taylor, the safest option, was the one suggested by this court's en banc order and the filing of a minimal claim. It's the one that...
He could have filed a minimal claim without discussing the Edgewood program. He could have said, I have these symptoms, I'd like the veterans' benefits as a result of that. And under cases like Shea, that's sufficient for an informal claim, no?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think Mr. Taylor's concern here is that he wouldn't have received benefits back in 1971 or 1972. And we understand that. It would have been very difficult for him back in 1972 to bring forth the evidence necessary to obtain benefits back then if he was could not speak of the Edgewood program. But as Your Honor points out, it would have acted as a placeholder.
But a lot of your placeholder argument is relying on the 2006 regulation. So the step we're missing is he would have had to divine in 1971 that however many years later, the DOD would, one, declassify the information, and two, the VA would issue a regulation that would allow for him to get retroactive benefits if he had filed a placeholder. How would he have divined necessarily that in 1971, that was all going to happen in ensuing years? Would that be a reasonable requirement on his part?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, again, we're talking about a high standard here of being completely foreclosed from court. And of course,
but doesn't it seem like it would have been a hopeless, empty exercise if you put yourself in Mr. Taylor's shoes in 1971?
Maybe not, Your Honor. I mean,
maybe not, because why? I can't even imagine what Mr. Taylor would think back in 1971 when he's under that strict secrecy order.
Right.
Can you imagine that there was some meaningful opportunity? I don't think there was one. I don't see how you can try to conjure up a scenario where there was one.
Let me pile on here a little bit, and that is, keep in mind that what you're asking him to do is speak to another agency other than the Army when he's been told by the Army that he will be prosecuted for talking to anyone about the whole program. He doesn't know what they're going to ask him. Now, go ahead.
I understand that, you know, Mr. Taylor, the record shows that he did speak about the Edgewood program afterwards, and he was mistreated when he spoke about it. He was told it was a fabrication. So I understand, the Secretary understands, that it was certainly in a terribly difficult situation. But if we're talking about whether the standard is completely foreclosed, futile, I mean, these are the words that are used in Christopher and the other decisions. Whether or not there was the possibility of filing a minimal claim has to come into play, because it is a tough, tough standard to meet to say that you're completely foreclosed from doing something.
But when they adopted the 2006 rule at the VA, they stated explicitly that the purpose of the rule is to clarify longstanding VA rules. And it repeatedly, in adopting the rules, this just codifies past practice. This is not new, right?
And yes, Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure as to when that practice began.
Where would this veteran have gained the knowledge of it? How in the world would this veteran have known that there existed in the VA some process by which he needs to file a minimal claim now, and then maybe someday if his particular program is declassified, he'll be entitled to benefits if he's not dead? Where exactly was a veteran to become aware of this supposed practice such that it wasn't futile?
Your Honor, this is completely coming out of speculation on my part, because I am not aware of the resources that were available in 1971-72 for veterans, but I'm imagining the American Legion and other organizations like that who have outreach for veterans were doing the same thing 50 years ago that they're doing today, albeit without the benefit of
the internet. So the government's position is it's not futile if 50 years ago veterans organizations were informing veterans that they should file such minimal claims. That's your argument?
No, that was a response to our question. To your question, Your Honor, our argument is very simple. It is minimal claim was an option. Because minimal claim was an option, regardless of how difficult it might have been, that means he was not completely foreclosed from court. That is the entirety of that argument.
When you say no matter how difficult... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just real quickly, when you look at Appendix 77, this is a statement in support of a claim. Mr. Taylor says, I sought behavioral health assistance at Edgewood Arsenal in service, but was denied. Says, I sought behavioral health assistance at Fort Benning, Georgia, and twice in Vietnam during service. Why isn't that at least a minimalist claim? If we're going to look at abbreviated facts, you don't have to show where you were or what caused your injury. All you have to state in order to have a minimalist claim is that you have these problems, and these problems relate back to the time. Seems to me this statement in support of the claim does just that.
Well, Your Honor, if Your Honor is sort of talking about the intent to file rule and all that, I think the quotes that you're citing to are when he's still in active duty. If he's in active...
This is signed October 7. He's saying that when he was in Vietnam, mm-hmm. he reported his injuries and nothing happened.
Right.
So what do you mean by a minimalist claim if this is not a minimalist claim here?
Well, I think he has to be a veteran to file a minimal claim. If he's still active duty, he doesn't qualify for benefits because he's not a veteran. He was still active duty at that time. I'm not saying, Your Honor, that – let me put it this way. I've seen nothing in the record that indicates that he filed a minimal claim post-service. Certainly, if he did, I would love to be aware of that because that will really change the dynamic of this case.
One of the things that I thought was most stark about your brief on this point is that the regulation says that it was, codifying past practice, though it doesn't explain where that past practice could be found or how it came about. Your brief doesn't cite to a single instance of that past practice actually occurring before 2006. And I would have thought if you had evidence that it really was past practice for any period of time that you would have come forward with that.
Well, Your Honor, obviously we, as I've said today, we thought the simple fact that a minimal claim was possible and the court suggested it would be sufficient to prove our point. But it seems like Your Honor would have appreciated examples. Hindsight, I would have loved to put those in, but we just thought that simply the fact of that this procedure exists.
Well, let me ask a follow-up.
Sure.
Your whole brief is all, peppered with, compelling government interests. Are you saying that the government has a compelling interest in having their soldiers interpret their secrecy oaths narrowly?
I'm not sure that those are – we're talking about compelling interest when we're talking about strict scrutiny, Your Honor.
Well, I think you'd want – the government's compelling interest would be to say they want those secrecy oaths to be interpreted as broadly possible.
Well, look, Your Honor, the Secretary recognizes that there are holes in our oath interpretation argument. We recognize that, which is why we led with the minimal claim one. The minimal claim argument really hammers down that there was an option for him.
But we don't know that there was an option until possibly 2006.
No, Your Honor. If the regulation that exists that was created in 2006 could be applied to a 1972, 73, 74.
Right. But Mr. Grimaldi, just in getting following up on Judge O'Malley's question and your response to Judge Dyke's earlier question about 3.156C and whether that was truly a codification of prior practice, we are very curious to know, was there something in the VA's manual that essentially set forth this kind of preservation of an earlier date that ultimately was quote-unquote codified in 3.156C?
Specifically the adjudication manual, Your Honor, I'm not aware of that, but I haven't...
Are you aware? Are you not aware of it because it never existed or because you just don't know the answer?
No, I was saying because I haven't looked, Your Honor, and we are happy to do that investigation for the court and let the court know if that did appear in writing somewhere for an individual to identify prior to 2006. But I have to say, look, Your Honor, I understand the timing issue here that this didn't exist until 2006, But the fact of the matter is that if he had filed a minimal claim before that time, the 2006 version of 3.156 would have kicked in. So that means there's no
So were there any other instances where veterans who were part of Edgewood disclosed information to the VA and received benefits? It's just kind of following up on Judge O'Malley's line of questioning here.
I'm pretty sure the three cases that we cite, DeAngelis, Ospedale, and Forrest, I believe it was, well, those are all three instances where the individual was not able to substantiate their service connection claim in the past, and were going back to the VA. So they, it does not appear that they substantiated their claims established and received service connection. That's why we're reading about them in the 2000s. But that doesn't disprove our point, Your Honor, that there was this option out there for him prior to the, not 2006, because these individuals did file something.
The program that was created, I guess, between DOD and the VA in terms of being able to carefully and safely handle benefits for people that served in special operations, was there anything that was preventing the government from doing something similar to that for people that were part of the Edgewood program? You're not, I just want to make clear that you're not suggesting that in the government's view, the national security issues were so much extra heightened for people in the Edgewood program that they could not have possibly done the same sort of thing that has been done for veterans that served in special operations. Am I right about that?
Yes, Your Honor, there's certainly special operations that
I mean, am I right about that?
I'm not sure if I say yes or no, which exactly position I'm taking.
Okay.
Your Honor. This is a question itself. So I'll just verbalize the Secretary's position on this. There are certainly special operations that are as sensitive or more sensitive than Edgewood, Your Honor. I imagine that is the scenario. Does that answer your question?
That's enough for me. Thanks.
Counsel, does the right of access line of cases require the ability to file what I'll call a meaningful claim? I mean, the government has admitted in his brief that had he filed in the 1970s, it could at most have been a placeholder. You don't even go so far as to say it would have for sure been a placeholder. It's just conceivable or possible it would have been. But I feel like the government did in fact concede that it would have been futile to imagine he would have actually received benefits without being able to disclose the actual stressor, namely details about the program. So does the right of access require simply being able to file a claim or to be able to file a meaningful claim for which there is any hope of actual benefit?
Well, Your Honor, this is a backward-looking claim, and we're looking backwards from 2022 at this point. So while it wouldn't have been successful, that minimal claim back in the 1970s, we now know because of 3.156 that relief would have been available to him within the VA system, within the benefit system. So I would dispute that it's not meaningful, Your Honor, because while it might have failed in the 70s, it would have been fixed, if you will, after 2006, and we wouldn't be here today. Mr. Taylor would have...
isn't the focus of the futility point on what was futile for him at the time? It seems awfully hindsight-oriented to suggest we now know decades later that it might not have been futile. It's conceivable it wouldn't have been futile. You don't even admit that it would have secured him an effective date. Are we really supposed to be looking with the hindsight of the present state of knowledge and the fact that the VA enacted this 2006 regulation, or are we supposed to be assessing the futility at the relevant time period when the claim should have, according to the government, have been filed?
Well, the relevant time period, it runs from 1971 all the way through up to when he filed his, claim. I can't remember the exact year, but it's well before 2019 when he filed the claim before the board and the Veterans Court, Your Honor. That's the time period.
It was 2007, right after your regulation.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So that's the relevant time period. It is the time period in which we are looking back as the whole time period when Christopher and the Supreme Court and Christopher v. Harbury looked at the whole period when looking back and saw that most likely for a certain time period, her husband was alive, and at a certain time period, he was deceased, and there was nothing to be done about it now because he was deceased.
Mr. Grimaldi, can I turn you to estoppel briefly?
Yes.
We spent a lot of time on right to access. I have a couple of questions about estoppel, and recognizing that Richmond is a big bar here, and frankly, I think it probably is a bar to us doing anything. Is there potential for the Supreme Court to modify Richmond in a limited way to recognize a unique brand of estoppel when the government rightfully exercises its national security powers, but that leads to unnecessarily unfair, equitable effects on people subject to that order? Is there a way to create a limited modification to Richmond's no estoppel rule that would recognize this area, very sensitive area of the law, where we wouldn't have to wade into whether the national security assertion is correct or balanced it or the like, but would just recognize that the government at some point can't rely on those interests to downstream prevent benefits?
And we're talking specifically about appropriation statute in your example, Your Honor?
Well, yes, assuming I think 5110 is akin to the kind of appropriation statute that was at issue in Richmond, is there a way for the Supreme Court to do that without opening and specifically confine it to this kind of national security interest without creating a kind of broader, you can't stop the government, which I suspect that they have no interest in doing, and of course the Justice Department is not going to support.
Yeah, Your Honor, I mean, if we're talking about separation of powers, I mean, OPM v. Richmond hinges completely on separation of powers and intruding on what Congress can and can't do, including what the court can and can't do regarding the Congress's power of the purse. Even if it's about national security, if it's still ordering the payment of money that's in conflict with the statute, OPM v. Richmond instructs that there's a separation of powers issue. I'm not sure how weighing national security in alters that separation of powers issue that the Supreme Court was concerned about.
So,
can
I just follow up briefly? Can I just ask you how that view relates to the remedy we're talking about here? Because if we view 5110 as a type of appropriations limit that can't be a stop, then in your view, is there any other authority that the court, either us or the Veterans Court, could use to order the secretary to not apply 5110?
Well, I mean, it's difficult in the sense that when looking at the blue brief and seeing what kind of instruction Mr. Taylor has requested from this court, it reads like a broad injunction in a class action, preventing the application of 5110 in a slew of cases. That kind of relief is just a backdoor attempt at equitable estoppel. Equitable estoppel fails. Let's try denial of right of access and then just ask for the exact same thing. The Veterans Court, looking at 7261 and your questions that you asked before, Your Honor, there's nothing in 7261 that allows the Veterans Court to find the statute that we're talking about here, 5110A, unconstitutional as applied.
Mr. Grimaldi, why doesn't 7261 do exactly that? It is a congressional authorization to the Veterans Court to set aside a denial of benefits, and that would be unconstitutional. And the denial here rests entirely on the application of 5110. I don't understand why there's an appropriations clause Richmond problem with that, because it is in fact statutorily authorized. And never mind about broad injunctions, the relief that the relief would be Taylor specific, unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Taylor.
Your Honor,
they would have precedential effect, but
well, sure, of course. But there isn't anything in 7261 that says the Veterans Court can find a statute to be unconstitutional as applied. Looking at 7292C,
it doesn't provide for setting aside board decisions that are contrary to the Constitution?
contrary to a constitutional right. That's correct. But
why is this not, I'm sorry, why is this not that if it's correct that there is a right of access violation on the assumption? Why is that?
Because it requires a determination that 5110A1 is unconstitutional as applied to Mr.
Why wouldn't it be if its enforcement would deny the right of access?
Well, Your Honor, if I can continue with 7292C, I think that will help us resolve this, which states that there's exclusive jurisdiction for this court to find a statute, a veterans benefit statute, unconstitutional. So, you know, it's a position of the Secretary that while this court can find something unconstitutional as complied, the Veterans Court cannot.
Oh, so why would that not be enough for relief in this case?
Well, I mean, I think the problem that we had with the relief that Mr. Taylor has requested is that, as I said before, it seems reads like a broad injunction in a class action. But beyond all that, there seems to be a step that's missing in the briefing, and that is he complains that the oath and the VA's processes violate his constitutional rights, and then at the end of the reply brief says, find 5110A unconstitutional as applied. But it doesn't go through the strict scrutiny of 5110A. So we would say that there would need to be another step in there to determine specifically that 5110A, A1 is unconstitutional as applied to him.
Can I
ask? Could you explain what is that missing step that they needed to articulate?
Well, I mean, it's implied. It's not articulated, Your Honor. And that is that if the argument that the oath violated his constitutional rights and that the VA violated his constitutional rights by not having alternative processes, and then the assumption that 5110A1 is unconstitutional as applied to him, there needs to be the application of strict scrutiny regarding 5110A1 to determine that it itself is unconstitutional as applied to him. Now, we would argue that it's not, Your Honor, because if you look at the option of filing a minimal claim, he had an option out there to get benefits. So there is survived strict scrutiny in there.
Okay, so if we disagreed with that argument by the government, then it is appropriate to find that 5110A1 in this particular instance would be unconstitutional as applied?
It is possible for this court to reach that conclusion under 7292C.
Okay.
Before you sit down, I want to ask quickly, assuming hypothetically that 5110 would be subject to equitable tolling, would you dispute at all that this is one instance in which equitable tolling would be appropriate?
I think that Mr. Taylor would have a very colorful case for equitable tolling, especially given his medical history and everything that he's been through.
I'd like to follow up with a hypothetical, if I may. I'll try not to take too long, Chief. Mr. Grimaldi, assuming that Mr. McLeod and I are correct, that in fact Mr. Taylor was faced with threats of both military criminal prosecution and civil criminal prosecution, would it not be unreasonable for a soldier in his position to believe that speaking to anyone about his symptoms, which are caused, he believes, by the gas, would violate those requirements and subject him to criminal prosecution?
I don't think that he would have to say anything like that, Your Honor. Yeah, I mean, yes. The short answer to your question is yes. It would not be unreasonable for him to think that, but it would certainly also not be unreasonable for him to put in a minimal claim that says, I have these symptoms, I can't talk about the stressor, I want benefits. I mean, we've talked about this at length, Your Honors. We concur that type of claim probably wouldn't receive benefits in 1972, 73 in that time period. But because of the 2006 changes.
Hey, just to be clear, you've agreed with me that a soldier in that position could reasonably believe that they can't say anything about their symptoms.
Because, as I stated before, we don't believe that we're talking about a reasonable person standard here. We're talking about objectively whether or not he's foreclosed, which is a very, very high standard.
But what about going back to the record where I pointed out in his statement in support of a claim, he says that he sought behavioral health assistance at Edgewood, the actual arsenal itself. Mm-hmm. And then twice during his Vietnam tours, and there he talks about his behavioral problems and all. Why is that not a minimal claim under these circumstances? If all we're looking for is a placeholder, right? Some sort of notice. That's it. That's all we're looking for. And yet the veteran says, and it's in his claim, that he did seek assistance and he didn't get it. And then my last question, my last point is this, is that we all know that the secretary has an obligation to assist the veteran in pursuing and prosecuting claims. Well, why shouldn't we not look at this statement that's made by the veteran that says he was denied assistance? So he was even denied the opportunity to file, or at that point, he was not told, this is what you need to do, go out and file a paper or do something else. Seems to me the record reflects that he did put a placeholder in place, and then that he was denied assistance. I mean, basic elementary assistance.
Your Honor, I would love for the record to say that he filed a minimal claim. I mean, that would make this case a lot easier. The paragraph that you're reading from, Your Honor, I'm struggling with it because it looks like he was in service asking his service, the Army, for help, not talking to the VA as a veteran. So I think that makes it really difficult to call that a minimal claim because he is not a veteran talking to VA. The duty of assistance.
You mean a minimal claim to the VA?
Correct.
So you're looking for more than a minimal claim. You're actually looking for a formal claim.
No, an informal one would be fine.
Well, he's talking to the U.S. government. I mean, he's talking to the health authorities at Edgewood Arsenal, and he's talking to, it could have been the VA. We don't know there, but he did seek health assistance. And why is that not a placeholder?
I'm struggling with that, Your Honor, because I'm thinking of other cases. I'm thinking about every time a soldier gets injured and goes to the first aid. Is that a claim? When they say, I've been injured, this could really snowball and be an administrative nightmare to determine if there was a holding that this itself was a minimal claim, talking to the Army about his injury while he's in the Army. This could really have lasting and detrimental impacts on the system itself.
Mr. Grimaldi, before you go, can I make a request that you go back and submit a letter, hopefully by the end of today, if possible, that provides where was there notice of a pre-existing practice of 3156C. I assume it was in the 2005 version of the VA manual, and then you could go back and see how far back in earlier versions of the VA manual that shows what was the origin of this practice and when was the public put on notice of it.
I will certainly get with VA to do that right away, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'm cautious to say that I'll be able to complete it today, but tomorrow at the latest, if that's okay with Your Honor.
Okay.
I have one more question. Is there nothing within the VA system that gives the secretary discretion to deal with this case and to award benefits as a discretionary matter under these circumstances?
You know, during the panel argument, Your Honor, there was a lot of discussion of 38 U.S.C. 305 and the discretion the secretary has to award to provide equitable relief when there's been an administrative error. It's hard to classify this instance as an administrative error. I've looked at the record, Your Honor, subsequent to all this and to that argument and preparing for today, and it does not seem that he has put forth an allegation that there has been an administrative error here. And as far as I understand, he has yet to ask the secretary for relief under 503. So I think that would be the only avenue, but I'm not sure it actually applies.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grimaldi. Mr. McLeod, we'll restore your full rebuttal time. Please proceed.
Your Honor, let me start by picking up on the point that Mr. Grimaldi just made about Section 503. We agree with Mr. Grimaldi that provision, unfortunately, is not applicable to Mr. Taylor's circumstances because there was not an administrative error in this case. The reason he didn't apply is because of the secrecy oath. Chief Judge Moore, you asked Mr. Grimaldi whether the standard for the right of access is meaningful access, and we think that that is the standard. The best case that I have seen for that proposition is the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson versus Avery. That was a case that involved a prison regulation that prevented prisoners from collaborating on habeas petitions. And the Supreme Court said it doesn't matter that these prisoners might be able to submit futile petitions. The question is whether they have effective access to the courts. So we think that the same thing is true here. The question is whether Mr. Taylor had effective access to the VA benefit system. And for all the reasons we've discussed this morning, we don't believe he had such access. On the question of what the standard should be with respect to potential changes in the bar that creates the problem for the right of access, I don't think that the standard can be any hypothetical future change in the standard invalidates the right of access claim. That would effectively eliminate certainly all forward-looking claims, because it's always possible that that bar might be dropped in a future case. It would also pose significant problems to backward-looking claims like Mr. Taylor's, for all of the reasons that the court has illuminated this morning. And so if the standard for a right of access claim were as the government articulates it, it's hard for me to see right of access being a meaningful form of relief. But we know from the Supreme Court and many other courts that the right of access is a vital aspect of the constitutional system, and certainly a right that can be vindicated. The final point I would make is with respect to relief. We do think that Section 7261 authorizes the Veterans Court to invalidate the provisions in 5110 that prevent Mr. Taylor from getting an earlier effective date if there is a finding of a violation of the right of access. But as Mr. Grimaldi suggested, we also think that this court itself, under its authority under 7292, could reach the same conclusion and produce the same result. If there are further questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we ask that the judgment of the Veterans Court be reversed in the case be remanded for a determination of the amount of benefits Mr. Taylor is owed.
Hearing no further questions, this case is taken under submission, and we thank both counsel for their arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.